Did you know that 43 million children and adults in our country may have dyslexia? Dyslexia is now considered to be the most common language-based learning disability, with most sources citing an estimated 15 to 20% of school-age children as being dyslexic. Today, we're going to talk about correcting dyslexia and the research behind it. This is LD Expert Live. Several years ago, a mom came in and told me the story of their journey with their dyslexic son. It was such a classic tale that I asked her if I could write it down to share. It's a little bit long, but I want to read it to you today because you may recognize your child in this story, or maybe even yourself. Here's what this mom said. She said, "Starting in kindergarten, the teachers have said that there was something wrong with my beautiful, friendly, athletic son. My son, who is an actor, who is so polite and mature. The kindergarten teacher wondered if it was dyslexia, but he was so young that the confusion with letters and getting words out of sequence and when telling things could just be a function of his age. Just be careful," the teacher said. So I was. In first grade, the teacher said, "I've been studying dyslexia and I know he's young, but I'm sure he has it. Let's get him tested." So I did. And the school psychologist said that he tested too high. His comprehension was too good. He didn't have dyslexia and nothing was wrong. Nothing was wrong. But my son couldn't read or write without a huge struggle. So we spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours in tutoring, hammering in the reading. Still, every year, the teacher sees that something is not right. In second grade, it was, "He comes up to my desk 20 times a day to ask questions. He's not listening." In third grade, it was, "He's got ADHD. Get him on medication." In fourth grade, he was lazy and not trying hard enough. Now in fifth grade, my son has started to hate school. He's cute and easygoing, intellectual and athletic, still acting and so normal in every way, except when it comes to reading and writing, especially writing. The words get jumbled in the sentences. Words he memorized for his spelling test are coming back completely misspelled when he writes. His papers come back with D's and F's and comments like, "Really? This was an open book test and this is the best you could do?" Today, my son said, "I don't think I'll make it to sixth grade." This mom went on to say, "After reading an article on dyslexia, I realized that it was describing my son and my husband and myself, my mother and my grandmother, my grandfather." She said, "If you had asked me yesterday, I would have said there was no history of dyslexia in my family. But now, my 82-year-old grandfather to this day cannot read or write. He passes birthday cards to my grandmother to read, blaming his vision. My mother sometimes says things that make us all wrinkle our brows as she puts words in the wrong place in sentences and mixes up sounds. She laughs it off and says, 'Oh, you know what I mean.' My husband is brilliant and accomplished, but I can't let him read to my son anymore because he reads so haltingly and leaves out or mixes up words. I have to correct every email he writes because the spelling and word order are atrocious. And me, well, I was a terrible student. I worked so hard and so long, but I never got good grades. And when my high school counselor asked what I wanted to be, I was told that what I'd set my sights on since second grade would not be possible for me, not with my grades. Thankfully, I was creative and started my own successful business while still in high school. She ended by saying, "I want a different story for my son." This is a story that we hear over and over from parents. Today, we are talking about dyslexia with one of the experts in the field. You can have a different story for your child. Welcome to the LD Expert Podcast, your place for answers and solutions for dyslexia, learning, and attention challenges. I'm your host, Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers, and author of a brand new book, Take the Stone Out of the Shoe, a must-have guide to understanding, supporting, and correcting dyslexia, learning, and attention challenges. This book will help you understand why some bright children and teens have more difficulty than expected in school. It provides simple, practical tools for supporting struggling students at home and in the classroom. Most importantly, it presents real solutions and the science behind them. My guest today is Dr. Joan Smith. Joan is a licensed school psychologist, licensed speech pathologist, and an incredible teacher and trainer, a researcher, and program developer. She is the author of the book, You Don't Have to Be Dyslexic, and I know you are going to love hearing from her. Welcome, Joan.
Well, thank you, Jill. It's good to see you back.
Yep, it's so great to have you back.
Yeah. You know, I was really intrigued with your story because I think it illustrated one of my favorite things, which is people who experience dyslexic learning styles are usually extremely bright, mm-hmm. extremely creative, and they're very talented. And I think that's the confusion that often prevents them from getting some help because they come.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They are able to cover it so well because they're smart and they're talented. And a lot of times people don't, they kind of look at these kids and because they might be very verbal or, you know, very talented in other ways or good at other things, they just feel like they're not trying hard enough.
Yes, yes. And that's what they're told, you know, if just try harder, you could do it. So they feel their problem, something that they're not doing, and feel guilty about that. They hide that too. So right. I think that's a huge piece. You know, when you have dyslexia, it's not just that you can't read, but you aren't getting information that's allowing you to gain content and to be able to share information that we experience in print. So it has a huge impact on our lives and it changes our course of our education. So it's really important for us to recognize it and do something about it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's something that follows people into adulthood as well. And I know you work with a lot of adults and we work with adults as well. And, you know, so often they really have good skills and maybe they're good managers, but they can't move up in their company because of the reading and writing demands.
Yes. So. And, you know, most of the time with the adults, what I'm seeing with them is that they're having difficulty with comprehension. So they can read words at that point because they've experienced them for so long, but they're not getting the information from it. Mm-hmm. And I had a wonderful gentleman who I thoroughly enjoyed. He phoned up and said, "Did I have a back door?" And I said, "What? A back door? Well, I don't think there's one on the clinic." And he said, "I didn't want anybody seeing me coming in." And so obviously, you know, he was embarrassed to come in and say I had an issue, but he knew he had needed help. And he finally made it in the front door. And he was an interesting person because he was a bank manager. And it moved up a great deal and the banks were being changed now. And he had the option to move into a very responsible position in the new bank. So he was like, "I need help now." And that made a big difference and was doable.
So, you know, people have heard about dyslexia for years, but most people, you know, when you hear the, you hear dyslexia, you think, oh, they just flip everything backwards. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit about what dyslexia is.
Well, you know, I think there, let's go back just a little bit further, even about 40 years ago, we started being able to, if we identified someone as dyslexic in our clinics, and you probably had this too, we could then get them help for taking the bar exam. They could have more time, or they could, you know, get all kinds of accommodations. And that was true on almost all of the different examinations or jobs that you needed to have. You could get accommodations. But the schools didn't recognize dyslexia as being a reality.
Right.
They said, well, that's just part of the reading problem or something else. And they didn't see it as any different. So it's only been in about the last 10 years that the schools have suddenly said, whoa, you know, what is this? I was at the school psych conference last year, and everybody, all the psychologists were saying, how do we test for this? You know, how do we know when someone's doing that? And I kept saying, you know, this is a no-brainer. What you're going to see is either they have trouble holding and recognizing the symbols in the first place. They've had trouble in gaining vocabulary because they don't recognize the words. Mm-hmm. They have trouble with the timing. They have trouble with reading quickly because they're really working on the words as they go through them. And it could be that they have trouble with comprehension. And those are all different elements that I think are related to dyslexic reading styles, but they often are confusing because everybody thinks it's going to be a reversal of a B or a D.
Right.
And that's a different kind. That's one of the very beginning ones in which it's a spatial orientation type of dyslexia. Is that what you find too?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I do find that, well, all of those things, that often there is a visual aspect. So there often is a visual spatial issue and an auditory issue where they're not able to really think about and process all of the sounds in words. So maybe they're not hearing and saying words correctly or recognizing their errors when they're reading. Often I find that our students have really good comprehension and they compensate with that. But then we do have other students that really struggle with accessing that vocabulary. So it's just different for every dyslexic learner, even though there are some common pieces.
Well, you know, and that's logical because we all have different brains. You know, our brains genetically are going to be different, but they also are different because of our experiences. And, you know, for me, if we can reach someone who has the possibility of becoming dyslexic when they start having to read, if we can reach them at ages 5 and 6, we can remove all of those issues that would have occurred. And so whenever we're, you know, we're waiting until, gee, they're 3 years behind or 2 years behind in terms of identification, wow, we could have taken care of this a long time ago, and we still can, but right, they've suffered in between. And we've seen issues with self-confidence and feelings like, you know, maybe I'm stupid, maybe I can't do this, a lot of embarrassment. So right, all of those are key that we identify them early.
Absolutely. You know, having been in this field so long, it is astounding to me that the common belief is that if you have dyslexia, it will just be a lifelong challenge and you'll have to find ways to cope with it. What are your thoughts about accommodations for dyslexia?
Oh, that's my favorite topic. Uh-oh. Okay. Well, first of all, when I have someone come in for testing and they say, I want to get accommodations for, you know, my student or my child in school, I am like, no, 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 no. You don't want to get accommodations. You want to get rid of the problem. You know, why have this? We are seeing students in school now, as soon as they're identified, being given often an aide who sits with them in the classroom. Mm-hmm. They're being given more time to do things. They have someone who reads to them. They have someone who writes the information down for them. And that's so disturbing to me, because who's going to follow them when they graduate?
Right.
Who's going to be there, you know, when they're trying to get a job to fill out the application? I don't think the aid is going to still be provided for them. And it's really not something we want to accommodate. Accommodations should be temporary,
right,
and only a first aid. And that's what I tell parents is, you know, we need to teach the student to read. We need to give them the skills. The accommodations are not going to build the skills. And yet this seems to be the theme that we're coming up with right now in all of the schools.
Yeah. And, you know, as you said, so many of our dyslexic learners are really bright. And so they're smart enough to know that they should be able to do this like everyone else, and they can't. And so then when they have all kinds of accommodations, it just sort of piles on that feeling of inadequacy and maybe I'm dumb, and because they can see the difference. They know what they should be able to do.
And you know what? They know it from age 5 and 6.
They do.
They see the other kids doing it. And as soon as they see them do it and they can't do it, you know, now we've established that belief that they're not okay in mm-hmm. their minds.
Right.
I had a little boy come in who was in kindergarten. And at that time, we had a private school in Sacramento for students who had dyslexia. And he said, "I failed in kindergarten." What do you mean? And he said, he was in a parochial school, and he said, "I failed in God's school." Oh. And I thought at the time, oh my gosh, what a burden that youngster is carrying with him.
Right.
And so I said to him, "You know, I don't really think that's what happened. I think that they weren't ready for you yet because you were ahead of them." And he said, "Really?" I said, "I think so. You should try that on. I think it'll fit better." And that's the kind of, you know, we need to verbalize, to reestablish who they are, and that this is not something that's a fault of theirs that they need to carry with them. They're okay.
Yes. Yeah. So one of the things that I really love about your work is that you always correlate the challenges and the solutions to the brain. So yes. Let's talk a little bit about the current brain research and kind of what it's showing about the dyslexic reader.
I'd love to talk about the brain, mm-hmm. you know, and I even have one. Well, I have two. I have one, I hope, upstairs here, but I have this one too. So I brought it for you to see today. And it kind of looks like a glob. But really what a brain is it's the consistency of pretty hard margarine. Okay. So it's pretty soft in that sense. And our brains have two hemispheres. They have one on the right and one on the left, so one on each side of the head. What we're doing at this point and what we know is so exciting, because for the first time in our profession, and I think for you and I especially, we can find out what's going on inside this structure as we're working with it. For many, many years, and for most of my professional time, I knew the input I was giving, and I could measure the output, but I didn't know what was going on in the middle other than to, you know, kind of make informed guesses about, okay, this is probably the area that's not working right. We need to work in this way. The exciting thing we know now is that this brain actually has different areas that acquire the information, and dyslexic brains are totally different in terms of where they're sending their information. Now, let's just talk about side for a minute, because we have the two hemispheres in our brain. one hemisphere is responsible for language and one is responsible for more spatial organization types of things. And they do share a lot of their information between the two of them. If you are primarily a right-hander, your information is actually going to be more likely on the left side of your brain. That's where you're going to be doing your reading, and most of your language is going to be coming in. And 90% of right-handers read on the left side, okay? People who are left-handers, it's kind of half and half. 50% go on one side, 50% would be on the other. So we aren't always sure whether they're reading on this side or this side. And for most things that we do, that doesn't matter because we're going to give that information and share it. Now, the language side of the brain then is absolutely key in processing reading. Now that we know that dyslexics tend to read up into the frontal lobe in the articulation area, we know that they are not activating the language part of the brain and the one that actually holds information like a good reader does. So this is going to mean we're going to make some changes in how we present information to individuals who have these issues. And I think that's the biggest key in why we're successful in relieving the symptoms that go with dyslexia, because we're actually going to target different ways of creating, I guess, pathways in the brain, connections, neurological connections, so that they actually begin holding information in the occipital temporal lobe, which is in the back of the brain. If you're a good reader and you're reading a novel and it's just playing before you and you're getting all that exciting information from it, basically, you're operating off of that part of the brain. You're not operating up here off of your articulation area. Your brain, and you know, one quick way of checking that for yourself is, if you read something out loud, you actually read it word by word by word by word. If you look at those words and you scan across them, you're getting that information, but your inner voice, that voice in the back of your head, reads it much faster than you can if you're having to articulate words. So it makes a difference if we're activating that area in the brain. Now, it's interesting because when a new reader starts to try to learn to read, it activates this area right up here, which also has been called Wernicke's area, or it's also our parietal temporal lobe of the brain. It's right in here, kind of above your ear. And they usually will see a word, figure out what it says a couple of times and add that meaning to it. And then it's stored in the occipital temporal lobe. If that person looks at that word and is trying to figure out b-a-t and trying to put those sounds together, you can already see they're doing it with their articulators, even if it's inside their head. And that's sending it up here to that frontal part of the brain. So every time we sound out a word, we activate what's called Broca's area, which is the frontal part of the brain. And quite honestly, one of the things that I really focus on, and I work with teachers and clinic staff, is to begin avoiding sounding out words, because we know that it automatically sends it to Broca's area. And instead, we have ways of teaching that we do not have to do that. And we don't have to create that fluency issue in reading that is so important for all of our readers. Is that?
Yeah, and that is kind of revolutionary, because for so many years, you know, there's been a big focus on sounding out words, but you know, that's where you can take a kid who actually has good comprehension, but when they go to read, they have no comprehension because they're not activating the part of the brain that's going to allow them to get the whole picture of what's going on. They're really stuck. And that was kind of a profound piece for me when I really began to understand that our dyslexic learners tend to get stuck. And so we think we're doing a good thing for them, having them sound out each word, but in reality, we might be perpetuating their being stuck there.
And, you know, I think, yeah, exactly. I think we've trained them to be dyslexic in that sense. So if they have the 10 difficulties at all, and we have them go through that process, you know, they think that's how they have to read. Mm-hmm. The underlying issue there, though, is memory. Okay, so it's their visual and their auditory memory, but the visual memory of looking at a word and automatically saying, I know what that says. Mm-hmm. If we have connected that, you know, what the word is, what it says, it's automatically going to be stored where it ought to be. And the pathway is going to be activated. If we haven't the adequate memory to do that, and, you know, that's always been my belief that most of the youngsters who come to us who have difficulty in beginning reading have memory issues. I worked with a gentleman, 27 years old, and he could not hold a single symbol and connect. Mm-hmm. We spent 3 weeks on the B sound and the A short vowel, ah. And I would show him the symbol B, and he would say, and I'd say, it says B, and he'd say B, and I go, good. What is it? And he'd say, B. And I'd say, and this one says, ah. And he'd say, ah. I'd say, and what was this one? Gone. Hmm. He couldn't hold it. So we worked his memory in every way we knew how. And within 3 weeks, he could hold two symbols. And within 3 months, he knew all the sounds and he was beginning to read. Hmm. And he became an effective reader. But we had to build the memory first to get him to hold it. He came to me, he was 27 then, about 20 years ago now probably, and said, my child's 5 years old, and I want to know what you did for me that I can do for him so that he doesn't experience what I did. Hmm. And, you know, so it is a memory issue in the beginning, I'm convinced. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's an attention issue also. But if you're having trouble with your memory, it's really boring to sit there and look at these symbols. And so you begin to, show attention problems. And that's why the youngster that you mentioned at the beginning of our program today, you know, was actually having people say he's ADD. He probably wasn't ADD. He probably was just bored, creative, and needed something to do. And so I think many youngsters who are called attention disordered actually have an issue of their memory's not functioning, or they're having trouble with, and that could be a visual or auditory memory. So they'd have trouble listening. They have trouble following directions, all those pieces.
And then when the brain isn't going to be able to pay attention if it's not making sense. And so that, especially a creative brain, because they can go off and so easily entertain themselves. We've been talking to Dr. Joan Smith, author of You Don't Have to Be Dyslexic, about the brain research around dyslexia. Most people still believe that if you have dyslexia, you're kind of stuck with it. But we have known for over 30 years that dyslexia can be corrected. So I want to talk about in this segment what is needed in an intervention in order for it to be effective in changing dyslexia. And I think this is really relevant to our parents who now see their kids at home, you know, with distance learning. They see this and they want to help. And also for teachers, because now schools are starting to have to at least acknowledge and try to address dyslexia. So this is some important stuff. What needs to be in an intervention?
Great. I'd like to introduce Susan Smith, who will be joining me here. And if we can sneak her into the picture also. There's two of us. Cool. Thank you. Susan And I've worked together for a number of years. We no longer count, I think, because that's been my best act on it. And Susan has worked as our clinic director. She has finally consented to come to where we are in Monterey this last year. And she is probably one of the finest therapists that I have ever known. Mm-hmm. And but she knows I think that about her. I would like to share with you a number of things that we're looking at. And Jill, you can kind of guide us if you would like on through this. When we first start working with someone who has any kind of a reading issue, and you know, I know there's a comfort in saying it's dyslexia, but sometimes it's difficult to just make a label like that. And so we need to just jump right in and say, this is what we need to do in order to resolve this so that it doesn't become a long-term issue for you. Okay. And the first thing that we do is if we're starting with a beginning reader, we're going to begin with a program in which we introduce the sound and to the symbol. And that's a key element so that when we say the sound of the word and we put a symbol out there, we want that connection to occur. Mm-hmm. And in order to be effective with this, and I think one of the biggest problems we have with most of the introduction to reading programs is they give too much information for the memory to handle in the beginning. And so we go to no more than 7 symbols, and we'll use 2 short vowels because they're easier. We want to build those in because it's easy, for instance, to look at an A and say it's A, but it's more confusing to say, oh, that says A or I. And we also like to use vowels that are pretty far apart so that they don't sound alike. Like I and E sound really a lot alike, right?
Yeah, they do.
and some of those. So we use 2 that are far apart. And then we use symbols like the B symbol, but we don't use the D in for a long time. And as a result of that, we never run into a BD confusion. So that makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. M, the T, S, and I don't know if there's another one we use. I think those are primarily the ones. B, M, T, F, and F is another one we'll use. And with those, we can make a whole bunch of words. We can make a whole bunch of syllables. And we can make a whole bunch of 2-letter ones. First, what we suggest doing is introduce just those symbols, and you always introduce them with the sound, not with the letter name. I don't know. I've never had a student who didn't automatically learn the alphabet name of it. Do you find that too? Yeah. So we give them the sound that goes with it and don't worry about this, what the basically the name of the letter is. Mm-hmm. So find me the A or find me the I. So they automatically do that. We're building at this point the pathway in the brain to hold the information. And we talked about this a little bit ago because we wanted to go directly into Wernicke's area for processing and then get storaged automatically into the occipital temporal lobe for the reading. Now, here we divert from what is commonly called sounding out. And that is, we're going to introduce now 2 symbols together. So we'll put the I together, the I and the T, and they're going to automatically learn that when they see that, they say it, at, im. It doesn't even have to be real words, but they put 2 sounds together and they hold that. And when they can recognize those automatically, we go to 3. What we're doing here is we're building their memory, but we're doing it with a limited number of symbols, and it can happen fairly rapidly. I saw Susan work with someone that we had just been testing, and he started out with the sounds, and then pretty soon they were working on 2 letters, and she already had him going into the 3 letters within a few hours. And it was like, you know, whoa, he can get this system pretty quickly. When we're doing that, we've now built in the memory, and we're building in the recognition of clusters. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when we read, We read with clusters. That's how, if you see a word like distenationing, you can actually read it because D-I-S, dis, is one you recognize. Ten, you recognized. And ation, A-T-I-O-N, you did, and I-N-G. If you tried to sound that out, it'd probably take a week. No, it would take quite a while to do that, and it probably wouldn't make any sense. I experienced that with one of my kids when we had first had the school, and the word was river. And he sat there going, river, river, river. And I kept going, and I couldn't, and finally I said, river. And he goes, oh, you mean the river? And I go, yeah. So it's very difficult if we don't already have those clusters and remember them. And if we can remember them, then we're going to build into words very, very quickly. Now, one of the things that we do when we're building that in is a whole bunch of different activities. And we have a program that we use, which is called a Learning Ability Platform. It's available with EduTherapeutics. And that program basically takes you through all of the different tasks that we're going to show you now. So that's something you can look at and get some ideas from, or you can actually use that program. First of all, one thing we like to do is something that Susan's an expert on, and it's called Word Flash. And I think I have some words here, but I don't know. There they are. They were hiding. Susan actually started this program, and I have, for me, it's been like, whoa, this is so cool. It works beautifully, right? Okay. So I'll let her show you one of the cards, and because she knows exactly what to do with this. But
all right. So can I use you as a...
Oh, good grief. Okay, yeah. Good thing I've memorized the cards. Okay.
So maybe I can scoot back a bit. So
okay.
We can
show them what you're going to show me
right.
First.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
All right. So maybe we could do both here. So I'm just going to flash this card really quickly. Okay.
Oh, okay.
But don't worry. You don't need a lot of time to get it.
Okay.
Okay. So here we go.
Okay.
Did you see it?
I did.
Okay. All right.
Let's see if they did. Do you want to flash it to them directly? Okay.
Okay. You think they got it?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Well, we just need to know that you got it.
I got it. That's the important piece, right? Okay.
So what you're going to do now is you're going to tell me what you saw.
Okay.
So, oh, dear.
I know. Okay. We have entertainment. I saw vocal.
Vocal.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm not going to give a lot to
no.
These. They can get... able to see them in you and you
okay.
As well. Okay. So
okay.
Here's your next one.
I'm ready. Oh, these are getting longer, Okay. I have it.
All right.
The word was fluent. Now I want to point out a couple of things here. She didn't leave it very long for me. She wasn't very nice about that. She just showed me really fast and down. But what's happened to me was I had to hold that image, hold it in my brain and remember it. And I can already spell that word, but if it were a word that I wasn't familiar with, I could actually spell it if she asked me to. And this really connects in your brain. You're building memory. You're building, of course, knowledge of those words, but you're also recording the sequence of letters in your brain and you're holding them. If you have a student who confuses the, starting where to go with it, you can always put, like, if you were working with a word and they needed to know which direction to go, you can always start. Do you usually use a red to start or a green to start?
I always use a green on the left so that they know how to read it. They're always going to read it from left to right.
So you'd put a green dot here. And then a red dot here.
Yeah.
So that they always know, okay, I'm looking at it in that direction. This is a really good technique for, you can use that with your beginning letters. When I'm doing beginning letters, I play with them. So we only have seven of them. And I'll say, okay, I've hidden the b sound somewhere around here. Can you find the m? And this active little youngster goes running around the room looking for that sound. If I'm really, interested in keeping their attention, I might use a little drum or something that I can tap on. And as they get closer to the sound gets louder or softer if they're moving away. So they're now doing auditory processing at the same time, and they're getting information as they're doing it. We can put three letters down, like the, and the M and the T sound. And I'll say, and we'll flash the word, all three of those letters. And then I'll say, find the M, and they'll go right to it and show you, good job, put it down, trace over it. And they can actually make that sound. There's so many ways of interest, making them interested in doing it and keeping them engaged. Mm-hmm. And, and then you're both having fun. So that's always something you do. Jill?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, those are great suggestions. And that flash words, it really can also build to holding more words.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Can you guys demo that?
I don't think we have one right here.
Don't have enough cards? Okay.
Yeah, but one of them would be, you can do phrases, like, I am fun, I am a man, whatever it is. You flash the phrase and they're holding it. Mm-hmm. That's how we read. Those are key ways in our reading. There's a couple of others we use a great deal with rhythm. And if we can just add that in, we'll use a chart like this. And I don't know if you can see that clearly, but they'll have words on it. And we do rhythm tasks with the reading. And Susan's found that, you do what, clapping with it? Is that what
it is? I was actually doing the crawl with it. Where you take your right hand and you lift your left knee and you push it down. And you can do this sitting down, so you don't have to get up at all. And what happens is your whole body takes over the rhythm, so that when you're reading the words, you're going to be reading them with the rhythm. So it just keeps that rhythm in place.
And this develops fluency in reading, mm-hmm. because you're having to do it, you're getting a move, you're getting a rhythm as you're doing it, and they're reading it. So it's like bed, bat, bid, bud, dab, and they're going back and forth with it. Really, really good exercise. But you can see that it engages even our active young kids in doing something like that. But it's also training them to their brain to hold that sequence of symbols, that cluster, and getting it immediately. You start that with just single letters, and you can do that at home. Put them on one of those wonderful white sheets that you can get at one of the office supply stores and that stick on the wall. And you just write on that, put the letters on it, and then you can read them together. You used to do that with a trampoline, didn't you?
Oh, I did.
Yes.
I no longer have one. But I have discovered that this works as well, if not even better, because you're moving both your hands and your feet at the same time and talking about getting both sides of the brain to work. And it's amazing for fluency and accuracy. I've seen huge differences. You can even do it with sight vocabulary, sight words, where they have to read the sight words. And there's a huge difference in learning them that way.
It is. And it becomes something that's very quick for them to do. There's a number of areas that one of the things we don't ever want to ignore in reading is teaching the student to add imagery to what it is they're seeing or the word that they're seeing. And so if we're doing like a phrase one, like, I see a dog. You show it, you read it. What's he look like? What color was he? Where is he? In other words, have them anchor words into that wonderful imagination of theirs, but mm-hmm. it's also then connecting them immediately to what that word meaning is. And it's a wonderful, wonderful technique. If you were using the LAP, you'll find that there's a whole series of different exercises like this, but it's primarily going to move you through working from individual sounds to clusters to all of these different pieces. The other piece that we're really working on right now, and we've seen tremendous changes is we're actually feeding in the information to the language center in the brain. And we'll do that by using a single headphone on one side that we occupy the spatial part of the brain with music while we give them the information on the other side. And we've seen rapid changes with that also. So there's just so many things that we're constantly learning, adding to our repertoire in making a difference for these kids. And I think it's so important for us to keep doing that. And Jill, you've been great at doing that too.
It has been a constant journey of learning, but it's really exciting. I, like you, I love, love, love working with this population of students. We are, believe it or not, at the top of the hour. So real quickly, we want to understand these critical components and then build them into everything we're doing. So we need to think in terms of building memory. And you saw when they were doing that word flash technique, which could be done with symbols or words, they were flashing it very quickly. It wasn't giving the student a chance to dwell on it and think about it and sound it out. It was very quick because visual memory, visual processing is fast. Mm-hmm. Yes. So we want to connect to that part of the brain. We want to add rhythm. If you're working on times tables or spelling words or sight word development, add rhythm to that. It's regulating and organizing and is going to help us to retain that information. We want to definitely connect language, words that we're hearing, that we're reading to mental images so that we understand what it's about. And then I know one of the other things that we work on and that Joan has built into the LAP program is processing speed. So all of those pieces, those four pieces are really critical to any intervention that you're going to do for dyslexia. The LAP program is the learning ability platform that Joan was talking about is a computer-based program. I have to tell you, it is very, very reasonably priced. It does activate all those pieces. And so, Joan, do you have anything that you would like to share with people about how they could learn more about it or access it?
Well, basically, if they go to the website, edutherapeutics.com, all of the information is there. And I think you shared with people my contact information, did you? And
we will be doing that.
And they can also contact me and I'll assist them in making any connections. And if they have certain questions, you know, I'm always happy to respond via email on that. I think the most important thing for all of us, and the reason that the LAP is out there is because we wanted to have a program available that included all the components that you and I know so well are critical in target therapy and training our brains to hold information and be effective in reading. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the main reason it's out there. The other piece is we wanted it to be accessible to teachers as well as schools. The clinics use it, but parents can use it at home too. And one of the things that's being added to it right now is a series of demonstrations that you'll get to see Susan, more of Susan on, in which for each of the activities, she shows other activities to do just using paper and pencil types of things that will augment it and give more opportunity to reinforce in them. You know, it's so important to me to reinforce that our brains are marvelous learners and they can change. So with any kind of appropriate teaching or therapy interventions, and the key here is think neuroplasticity. That means our brains can change, they can add information, and they can become very, very effective. We have that opportunity for all of our dyslexic learners, and there's no reason for them to experience frustration for their lives.
Absolutely.
Get it all in place for them. And we appreciate being able to share that with you today.
Well, and I appreciate you both being here with us to share it and all of your work in this field, because it is truly incredible and has impacted thousands of children and adults. And Susan, thank you so much for joining us. You both have made so many contributions to the field of learning and attention and dyslexia, and it is always a joy and an honor to have you. Joan practices in the Monterey Salinas area in California. Her specialty is in developing and implementing targeted therapies for the resolution of learning challenges. Be sure and check out her books and the new Learning Ability Platform program on her website.